The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, so it's time for the regular hour with my dear friend Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I am with you, yes. Thank you very much. And
thank
Andrew,
you so much.
Good to be back.
Yeah, great to have you back as always. And I'm just going to timestamp the show. So it is 10:01 a.m. here in the UK, making it a minute past midday over in South Africa where Peter is. It is Tuesday, December 3rd, 2024. And the subject for today's presentation that Peter's going to do is the real story of why assisted dying is a bad idea. So, Peter, where would you like to start us off with today's topic?
Well, of course, there's so much controversy and news and shock around the world hearing about the United Kingdom passing the first part of this assisted dying bill. Now, they're trying to differentiate between assisted dying and euthanasia. And, of course, euthanasia is where a doctor administers, or some physician administers, lethal drugs to end a person's life. Whereas assisted dying, I think the distinction is allowing a person who's terminally ill to receive lethal drugs from a medical practitioner, but they administer it themselves. So this is the fine definition change. So the reason why they're calling this assisted dying is they're trying to say the physician doesn't kill the patient. The physician only enables the patient to kill themselves. So it's basically assisted suicide, I think, is a better term. What they're calling assisted dying, I would call physician-assisted suicide. I think that's more accurate, but they're obviously trying to avoid the word suicide, which is against the law, mind you. And euthanasia is still against the law. But what we're dealing with here is a very interesting psychological warfare campaign. Just seeing the pictures out there, they have got these pictures. A lot of them are wearing pink outfits. We see standing outside Big Ben and the Palace of Westminster, the House of Commons, and they've got these comments: "Let us choose, legalize assisted dying. Let us choose." Well, I don't recall those people being out there saying "Let us choose" when it came to the COVID cult, lockdown lunacy, masquerade madness. No, you couldn't choose when it came to the masks, because after all, it's not your body, your choice. It's your body, the government's choice, or should we say, the Wuhan Health Organization's choice, or the CDC or Fauci's choice, but it's not your choice. My body, my choice only applies to abortion. It doesn't apply to it when it's really your body and you don't want an experimental jab, the clot shot, the Fauci ouchie, whatever they wanted to call it. And this "let us choose," I think, is absolute fiction, because there's a whole lot of factors involved in this. There are a few countries in the world that allow physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. And that would be the Netherlands, Belgium, Spain, Switzerland, Luxembourg. Most countries ban this. And the reason is it's a real slippery slope. And to give you an example, when I was in the Netherlands, the people there were pointing out that in 1 year, government-employed medical professionals, that's state employees, chose to euthanize 1,000 people without the patient's request or even the relative's request. So imagine that a government employee, which is what the doctors in the Netherlands are, chooses to kill a patient. Now, it could be just we're short of beds, or it could be the cost of government health insurance. The cost of helping this person is just too high, or we've got to cut our budget, or we over budget for this month or this week, or we're short of beds in this area. And so, give this lethal cocktail of drugs to this person. Let's clear that bed out so we've got space for someone else. It could be like that, or it could be a relative who's greedy for the inheritance, wants to get as much as possible, wants as little as possible of their parents or grandparents' fortune to be expended in their medical care for the end of their life. And let's maximize my inheritance. Doctor, could you please help my beloved parents or whatever along so that they die quickly before the end of the day or the end of the week? And then they get more inheritance. So there's so much conflicts of interest involved in this. So physician-assisted suicide, or what the British House of Commons is calling assisted dying, is contentious, and it should be contentious. And just to give a quote from a doctor connected with hospice. Now, this is a very real subject for me. My mother had quite unpleasant last few years of her life because she had lost her leg due to gangrene, smoking-related, and her leg had gotten gangrenous and her leg needed to be amputated. So she lost her leg and a lot of her independence. And my mother was someone who kept giving me harassment to sign euthanasia, this, that, and the other, which is illegal in South Africa. And in fact, she forbade me to ever authorize any kind of amputations and so on, which I saw as very hypothetical, but it actually happened. My mother, being a nurse, was a very bad patient, and nurses do make shocking patients. They're very difficult. They know what's involved, and they can be extremely argumentative about what medical procedures are being done or not done. So my mother had this paranoia about, I don't ever want any part of my body amputated. And so one day I was called to the hospital and told, my mother's in a coma, and she's flat refused all along to have an amputation. It first started with, they need to amputate her toe. And it was going gangrenous, and her smoking had clogged up her artery, so the extremity of her body was going gangrenous. But then it needed to be her foot, and then it needed to be her leg below the knee. By the time it became my decision, as her next of kin, it was her leg above the knee. So I was told by the doctor, she is going to die. Her gangrene is poisoning her to death. She was already grey, and I'm being told, you must authorize the amputation or she will not survive. Now, I had a clear choice to make. I was her younger son, but still, I was in town and she is staying with us. So I needed to authorize this. I contacted my elder brother, and he is about 1,000 miles away up in Johannesburg. And he said, well, you're in Cape Town. There's no use mom hating both of us. You signed the authorization, which I did. I mean, it was very clear. Either my mother dies or she has this amputation. Now, I knew she'd be super angry at me, and she was super angry with me. But a few days after operation, the color had returned to her. She'd gone from gray to a healthy sort of color pink. And I could bring her grandchildren to see her because I couldn't let them see their grandmother when she is absolutely gray, ashen. She was plainly dying. I mean, it looked like she was already dead when she was in a coma. And so there's a case where the amputation saved her life. Now, my mother was angry. She didn't want it. But my mother was very secular. She is traumatized by the Second World War, experienced 1,000 bomber raids and all of that. And my mother said, you couldn't believe in God because of what happened in the Second World War. My father said the same thing. And he is the North Africa and the Eighth Army. But my parents were totally secular. So there was no Bible, no prayer, no grace before meals, no church, or not even on Christmas Day. We never went to church. We never went to Sunday school. I was raised in a secular home. But now my mother, having lost her leg, lost her independence, she was no longer able to stay in her apartment, which was on the second floor, and there were only stairs. There was no elevator or anything like that. So we built a cottage in our back garden, moved my mother into a home, and later into a cottage in the back garden. And I said to my mother when she moved home, Mom, I understand your views, but for the sake of your grandchildren, please, you must attend our family devotions, Bible readings, and prayer each day, and join us for church on Sunday. Your grandchildren wouldn't understand if you didn't. And she saw that immediately, and she wanted her grandchildren to be blessed in every way. So my mother started to attend church and devotions, and she enjoyed it. I mean, she is argumentative at first, but that was an inquiring mind. That was good. But she was listening. She was thinking. And my mother came to the Lord, and she is converted. So we not only saved her physical life, she experienced spiritual salvation. She was regenerate, born again. My mother became an enthusiastic Christian, even donated her time in the last years of her life to working at our mission, handled our mailing lists back when we had a postal service that worked. And I've got no doubt that that amputation saved her life for now and for eternity. She had an extra 3.5 years of her life as a result of that amputation. And my mother's request over and over for euthanasia, we saw that as wrong. So I just saw the most important thing was we needed to get pain control. She needed to be made comfortable. So the doctors that we employed worked on dealing with her pain level so that she was comfortable, so that she didn't carry on demanding euthanasia. Because my mother did not like being dependent on others. She was a very independent person. She even liked going and doing her own shopping. So we got her a prosthetic limb. At first, she had to use walkers and crutches, but soon she was able to walk with her with just a walking stick and a prosthesis, one of these plastic and metal legs. So my mother's case, although she was demanding euthanasia, we dealt with issues. She felt needed. She felt loved. She felt wanted. She loved being with her grandchildren, and I think her last years were so much more pleasant. So we avoided that demand for euthanasia just by dealing with the real issue, which was pain and comfort and a meaning and purpose in life. She felt like her life was over when she lost her leg because she could no longer be a nurse. But when she came into her home, she is involved in so many different issues helping her grandchildren. One of our children, Christopher, had kidney failure, and so he was a medical drama from the day he was born. And my mom would spend the nights in the hospital with him. She'd sit in the chair next to his bed. She'd never leave him alone at night. We'd be with him during the day. She did not trust the other nurses, and my mother was like a Rottweiler dog protecting, or I should say like a German Shepherd, protecting her ward, her pack. And she got new purpose in her life, being involved in the medical dramas in our family, and especially Christopher, who is definitely her favorite grandson because he has a medical crisis. And I remember my mother coming into our home sometimes saying, "My day is not complete if I haven't seen blood." And I mean, she was a real nurse. She just loved medical crises. She lived to serve others. And when she had a purpose, when she was given a reason to live in our home, pouring herself into the grandchildren, pouring herself into the work at the mission, it gave a purpose in life.
Yes, I think it's important to just take a moment, Peter. I think it's such an important story, this, because many people, when you hear Peter, you think, you know, he's got such a knowledge and such faith and what have you in the Bible. And you can't imagine that he was raised by parents who weren't religious and things like that. And many of you won't be able to imagine how, even not so many years ago, with Peter's faith and what have you, his mother was still very much non-receptive to God and things like that, and how even with that, Peter's mother was looking at euthanasia and what have you as something that she would like to do, although not able to do legally in South Africa. So we can actually put a human face on what we see today, when someone can actually think to themselves, "No, I want to be out of here," what have you, and then actually they end up having some of the best time of their life for another 3.5 years. So, Peter, would you like to continue?
Yes, in fact, we went through this almost a duplicate with my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was also a registered nurse. She was her whole life very much in the medical profession, and like any nurse, a very difficult patient. And she, after her husband died of cancer, and she was very much losing her whole purpose in life. She She had, her whole life had been serving her husband, the mission, and when her husband died, it's like she no longer had a reason to live. And my wife, Lenora, went up to America, to Arizona, to be with her mother, cared for her for the last months of her life, and she was also putting tremendous pressure on my wife for euthanasia, which, of course, was not legal in America either. But again, we saw the real need, as I was reminding Lenora from my mother's experience. She needs pain control and she needs purpose. And so helping her to really get her purpose in life and see how much she can still do for her grandchildren and great-grandchildren in her case, that made all the difference.
Yes, I think that this, again, is obviously this is a very difficult show to talk about things like this, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, I, for example, my mother, I'll just throw this in. For the last few years, this sounds very, very strange, but she was always quite stressed, what have you, and I would do what I could to help her. But now that she actually has the dementia and she's in that old people's home, she's happier than I've seen her in a long, long time. She had to deal with my, you know, father, my stepfather. He passed away over time due to dementia as well and other reasons. And she cared for him at home. And then she got loneliness. And whilst I would go over there and visit her every week, it wasn't really enough. I'd like to have gone more and I'd like her to have seen other people. But I think that that probably didn't help the dementia. But when I go and see her now, she's just always happy in the home. And it's one of those things that it's weird because she's not the person that she was, but in herself she seems happier than I've seen her for a very long time. Peter, would you like to continue?
Yes, so euthanasia comes from the word well, you means well, and thanos, which means death. So basically, it's from the Greek word meaning a well death or a well done death. So this has come to be adopted for painless or happy death, that it's a death well done. It's also come now to cover things like mercy killing, where dictionary definition is in extreme suffering or to save abnormal babies, the mentally ill or the incurably sick, which might have been suffering for years. We should help end their life so as not to impose too heavy a burden on their families or on society. Now, that's straight a dictionary definition. So euthanasia is actually the deliberate killing of an innocent human being. And it is actually murder, and it's been considered murder by law for centuries, and especially in British law as well, that you cannot have such a thing as a mercy killing. Killing is murder, and it's unacceptable. So you've then got to differentiate between voluntary euthanasia, where an individual chooses euthanasia, such as my mother wanted, but of course as her son and guardian at that stage I was not willing to consider, and also the laws of this country, of my country, prevented it. But bear in mind, in the case of a person who's got a mental condition, how on earth can it be voluntary? And so, you know, you just think of a person who might have dementia. How do they really have the capacity to make a truly voluntary choice? And then in some cases, they say it's voluntary, but it's for a baby who's been born handicapped. And my mother was told to have me aborted because she had been taking thalidomide tablets. And this is something that's also important. Doctors can be wrong. Doctors frequently are wrong. And while South Africa laws against abortion, very strong laws against abortion at that time, because of the paranoia and hysteria back in 1959, 1960 over children born horribly deformed because of thalidomide. Thalidomide was the wonder drug that dealt with issues like morning sickness. And so my mother had access to thalidomide tablets as a nurse, and she had taken them, and she was told by the doctor, you must have an abortion. Not you can have an abortion, you must have an abortion. This child will be born deformed. He won't have arms or legs or eyes. And that happened in thousands of cases. Children were born horribly deformed because of thalidomide. And so there was my mother told, you must have an abortion. And either the doctors were wrong or God did a miracle, because my mother called for a chaplain, which, bearing in mind that she was steadfastly non-religious, she did not believe in God. She had been traumatized by the Second World War, the 1,000 bomber raids and all of that in Berlin. And she had come to the conclusion God cannot exist because of all these evils that take place in the world, which we should note are evils done by people in rebellion to God and in violation of his laws. So it doesn't seem fair to blame God. But she called on the chaplain and I was born healthy. I've got all my arms, legs, eyes. So there is a case where a euthanasia could have been done, well, an abortion in that case, that would have been a physician-assisted murder. And the doctors were wrong or God overruled. Either way, I'm glad that my mother chose life. But then, of course, you get involuntary euthanasia. And this happens continually in countries like Belgium and Netherlands, where doctors who are employed by the state can choose to euthanize a patient, even if the patient hasn't requested it, even if the relatives haven't even requested it. And there's so many possible complications or confusions of interest. It's so bad now that you get people in the Netherlands walking around with wristbands which say, please treat me, because so many of the medical professionals have the instructions to them in Netherlands and in Belgium that if an old person dies, don't resuscitate them, or if they lose consciousness, don't do CPR, leave them. In fact, it's so bad that you get many hospitals we're talking again about Belgium and even Netherlands, where there will be a sign on the end of the bed, nil per mouth, meaning don't feed them, and that can also be no water either. And so they take out the feeding tubes, they take out the water tubes, which are keeping this person alive, and they like to call it withholding of medical care. But food and water is not medical care. A patient dying of thirst, refusing to give a blood transfusion or removal of a life support machine, this is actually just murder, letting them die of starvation or die of thirst. And that's common. Then there's also active euthanasia, where you can actually introduce an overdose of morphine or insulin. And I was deeply distressed that at one point we noticed that the hospice people who were helping us care for my wife, who was dying of cancer in our home, and literally right next to me. And when I was going each night, I had the night duty caring for my wife and my children sort of during the daytime. And we were keeping a track of what medicine she was getting in an excise book and trying to work out how often and how much has been given. And we noticed midazolam. Now, she's getting morphine for the pain and she's getting midazolam. And doing research, we discovered midazolam is often used as an end-of-life conscious sedation to get the patient ready to die, basically. And midazolam and morphine is a toxic mix. And so we challenged the hospice doctor who would come in every now and then and just supervise our untrained expertise. My wife, when she was being told that she was in the last months, she said, I want to die at home amongst my family, not at hospital among strangers. This is 2021, when you had this hideous COVID lockdown lunacy where nobody was even allowed to visit their relatives in the hospital. People were dying alone without their children, grandchildren, relatives around. And so we chose to be at home. And in doing my research, I discovered the hospice people were giving my wife midazolam, which was definitely hastening the end of her life. And that is also a form of euthanasia. And we have got to resist this. And so we really objected seriously. And I'm told so many people during the COVID lockdown, their loved ones passed away through a toxic mix of midazolam and morphine. And there's testimonies of that, which we picked up on the internet and realized, no, we don't want them to be doing this to us. And so there's all the difference in the world between giving a person a drug to relieve their suffering and giving them a drug in order to kill them. And euthanasia is not part of medical practice. It's forbidden by the laws of any civilized country and by the ethics of the medical profession, and it should be forbidden by the conscience of the doctor. Their Hippocratic oath is meant to be, I will first do my patient no harm. And to think that we could turn doctors into paid assassins who will end a person's life. It's almost like a hitman, except they use a syringe instead of using a gun or a knife. And it's unacceptable. So to have this assisted dying bill, or what I would call physician-assisted suicide, it's actually murder. It's suicide in Afrikaans. In South Africa, the term suicide in Afrikaans is self-moord or self-murder. And I think that's the best description of suicide. Suicide is a self-murder. So whether we're dealing with voluntary euthanasia, so-called, which there's problems with that because often it's not even that voluntary, but then also think of a person who may think, I'm being a burden to my family. And the people who choose maybe euthanasia because they feel like I'm a burden to my family, or my medical care is costing too much and I don't want to be a burden. And some people feel a burden on themselves to say, just give me the physician-assisted suicide, assisted dying, whatever it is, because they feel they're a burden. When they know that they're loved, appreciated, wanted, and they have purpose, and when their pain is being controlled, you'll find that people are not requesting it. But involuntary euthanasia is what's going on in many places in the world, and I predict the US and UK experience is going to head to. It's a slippery slope. Once you allow voluntary, it soon moves to involuntary. Once you allow passive euthanasia, which is withholding of treatment, withholding of water and food, you will head to active euthanasia very quickly as well. And so that's why we, in the pro-life movement, use the words, we stand for the sanctity of human life from conception to natural death. And natural death means the person's dying of natural causes, not of some kind of physician's drugs being administered, or being starved to death, or being withheld from water so that they literally die of dehydration. That is not physician-assisted suicide, that's murder. And we've got to use the words of the medical profession, you should cure sometimes, relieve often, and comfort always. And that's what a medical doctor and a nurse is meant to do, relieve the patient's suffering. You relieve their suffering not by killing the patient, but by making them comfortable, controlling the pain, and also ministering to them, body, mind, and spirit, that they feel valued and appreciated. So when a person is dying, sometimes the treatment is given to relieve the pain and make the person comfortable, but sometimes that medicine, like the midazolam, may shorten their life as well. And the doctor should weigh up the balance. And just to quote from one doctor, someone is dying of an advanced heart failure. Morphine will relieve the distressing breathlessness of this condition, although breathing may be less efficient after the morphine has been given. But the doctor's duty is he must relieve the distressing symptoms and he administers the appropriate treatment. But this is the difference between giving a drug to relieve your suffering and giving a person a drug in order to hasten their death. And that's two different things. If you are relieving a patient's suffering, you can enable that person to have the time and attention necessary to conclude their life, to restore their relationships, to leave their last thoughts with their family, maybe to sort out their will, to hand over responsibilities, codes, whatever it may be, and to leave their last thoughts with their family. Most importantly, you must give people who are dying the opportunity to get right with God and to be sure that they've considered their eternal situation, their salvation, that they may come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. That's what happened with my mother. She was not a Christian when she went into that coma, and she became a Christian in the last 3.5 years of her life, living with us in our home. And if you don't give treatment to relieve suffering, that may shorten the life, and the person may really be so preoccupied with their pain and distress they can't deal with anything or anyone else. So we've got to make a clear distinction. There are activities that cause death, they're designed to cause death, and there's actions designed to relieve suffering. Euthanasia is forbidden by law, and it should always be forbidden by law in any civilized country. And the rest of us in the world are shocked that Britain's guardians or legislators, who should be protecting life and liberty, have actually eroded one of the foundational pillars of any civilized society and of the medical profession. They are to save life, not to take it. Now, we've got a strong biblical basis to oppose assisted dying and euthanasia. God is the creator. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who has made us and we are his. God has forbidden us to take human life. You shall not commit murder is the sixth commandment, as we find Exodus 20. You shall not put an innocent or honest person to death. I will not acquit the guilty, we read in Exodus 23, verse 7. We are told over and over in the scriptures, like in Deuteronomy 19, verse 13, you are to show no pity to a murderer. You must purge from the land the guilt of shedding innocent blood, that it may go well with you. And we are told to respect the aged. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you, that you may enjoy long life on the earth. That's Ephesians 6, verse 2 to 3. It's repeated throughout Proverbs and Mark chapter 7. And the Bible also tells us not only that God is the creator and he's forbidden us to take human life, innocent life, and we to respect the aged, but there's a value to a handicapped life. At one point we read in John chapter 9 that the Lord saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Teacher, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he is born blind?" And Jesus responded, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. This happened to show the work of God that may be displayed in his life." And God healed this blind man. So the Lord expressly taught that a person's illness is not necessarily a sign of any sin or any displeasure from God at all. And the Lord could have made it much stronger. Now, what's wrong with this assisted dying bill is it's extremely difficult to define. A person becomes seriously ill and the doctor tells him he cannot cure him. The patient may feel he cannot cope with his illness and he requests his doctor to put him to sleep painlessly and quietly. Now, possibly this person wants to ensure that his wishes will be carried out and he might even put on paper before the time. But is it straightforward? Because interpreting the terms is difficult. Some people say with assisted dying, it should be available to those who request it. It's proposed that it should be available to those who are believed to be suffering from a serious physical ailment or impairment, and it is thought to be incurable. But first of all, how voluntary is it? When the person wrote that assisted dying authorization, did they understand what they would face later? They may not be able to fully anticipate all the advances in medical technology that may one day be able to cure what he thinks would be incurable now. And then what about someone other than the patient makes a decision? How voluntary is it if it's a relative who's standing to gain from the inheritance? They said where there's a will, there's relatives. Now, you've also got to decide what is meant by severe distress. Now, severe distress, when it comes, may change its meaning, because what if you suddenly have a reason that you want to live, to see your son graduate or the birth of that grandchild or a special anniversary? And if the patient's suffering so much that they request euthanasia or assisted suicide, surely the answer is not to kill the patient, but to relieve their distress, to relieve the pain, and to give them a real purpose to stay alive, which is where their relatives can play such a key role, especially grandchildren. Many people who are suffering from what they think is an incurable disease may feel that they've become a burden to those who are caring for them. And then they may feel obligated to request euthanasia to relieve their relative's burden. The amount of times I've heard people like my mother say, "I don't want to be a burden to anyone." And they've got to realize you're not a burden, you're a blessing. We want you. We don't want you to take the, I can't call it the easy way out, but the quick way out, whatever it is. It's unreasonable to suggest that some people would take advantage of a situation to free themselves from an aged or sick relative. There are relatives who literally, and I've heard people talk like this, you know, how can we sort of gonk grandma over the head or this side or the other? You know, there's a real burden. And some of them, if some doctor would help them get rid of this responsibility, this burden. Now, you think our parents went through a lot of inconvenience to care for us when we were small and noisy and difficult and very needy. And at the end of life, is it unreasonable for them to expect that they're going to be cared for by the children that they put so many years of love and care into when we were extremely difficult? And, you know, who wants to deal with crying babies in the middle of the night or sick crying babies in the middle of the night? But our parents cared for us. We should care for them. And so doctors also make mistakes. The end of life is a time when people need love and care. And the availability of euthanasia, just the availability, could cast a tremendous shadow of suspicion and fear over the last part of a person's journey. You know, am I going to be gotten rid of in the middle of the night? And I've seen cartoons of a person in the hospital with tubes on him saying, I'm going to take a quick nap. You watch my tubes while I'm sleeping, and yeah, the other person doing the same back later. That's shocking to think that people start looking at their doctors as this may be the person who's my executioner instead of the person who's there to care for my needs and to look after me. And so doctors should never become hitmen. And before requesting euthanasia, a person obviously should be aware of all the facts. Doctors should be able to say, you have this disease and you'll die in so many months and I cannot cure you and neither can anyone else. But doctors are human and doctors make mistakes. And we could see, in fact, during the COVID cult lockdown lunacy, doctors did make mistakes, maybe with all good intentions, but they believed the lying Wuhan Health Organization, they believed the lying CDC and the treacherous Anthony Fauci and his duplicitous nonsense, his absolute pathological lies, how he went from one position to another. No, this could not have come from a laboratory. No, this is from a wet market. Well, actually, it does come from a laboratory, but we had nothing to do with it. Okay, well, we were funding the laboratory, but not for this specific project. Okay, we were funding gain of function where literally they were taking a disease and making it 10,000 times more contagious than it would be a natural life. And yes, we were funding the whole operation. And well, yes, Wuhan Biological Institute is run by the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military, and their biological warfare laboratory is in the same place that we were funding. But there's nothing to see here. This wasn't maliciously intended. And the more we look, the more lies we see. Safe and effective. Well, in fact, later the head of Pfizer admitted before the Dutch parliament, they weren't safe, they weren't effective. We didn't even have time to test them. They had to come out so quickly. But how many times did they keep telling you, this is safe and effective. If you take this vaccine, you will not get COVID. Do you remember these people like Biden assuring you? In Britain, there was, who was the prime minister at that time, who was saying, I assure you, if you get this vaccine, you will not get COVID. And then both the British prime minister, the American president, the South African president, Ramaphosa, they all got COVID. Even Fauci got COVID. Even after being double, treble, quadruple boosted, having all the different shots they should have got. And they had assured us, if you get this vaccine, I promise you, you will not get COVID. And then you get the vaccine and then people died and then people had heart attacks and strokes and they still got COVID anyway. And they still had to wear the mask and they still had to socially distance. So what was the point? Those of us who refused to get the vaccine did better than the people who did get it. And friends of mine who got the vaccine and have been sick on so many levels since then, heart attacks, strokes, all sorts of things. And I'm so glad I did not get that. So not only do doctors make mistakes, sometimes doctors pass on disinformation, whether they're meant to or not is a question. But sometimes they've been trusting the pharmaceutical companies and the CDC and WHO who've been lying to them. So we've got to be sure of the fact that doctors are not God. Doctors can be wrong. Doctors can make mistakes. Doctors can also be deceived and believe disinformation and pass disinformation on. So just a few examples. Jim Curley was told he had inoperable cancer and he had 3 months to live. But he outlived his doctor and today he's retired. He spends time with his grandchildren, two of his grandchildren were born after he was expected to be dead. Then there's Kelly Markham, told by doctors, you have only 6 months to live and your left leg needs to be amputated from the hip. The doctors were wrong. And 10 years later, Kelly Markham is still alive and she's happily married and without needing to have her leg amputated. So doctors do make mistakes frequently. And then inevitably, when you start a discussion on euthanasia, the topic swings from voluntary to involuntary euthanasia. Just quoting from Dr. Everett Koop, the former US Surgeon General, who said, euthanasia opens up the opportunity at an early stage of the game for every conceivable fraud, deception, and deceit. Think about elderly people who are economically burdensome, whose rapid demise could be looked upon as an economic blessing for their family and society. Think of the temptation to hasten the legacy and inheritance. Think how easy, when there are ulterior motives, to emphasize the ending of suffering and ending of anxiety that is promised with a painless death. And this was reinforced by Dr. Nigel Sykes, a consultant in palliative care at the St. Christopher's Hospice in London. Speaking at the Hospice Association in 1995 at the National Congress in Stellenbosch, not far from Cape Town, he said there was concern at the growth of the number of non-voluntary euthanasia cases in Holland, where in a single year, more than 1,000 people in the Netherlands have been given euthanasia without their consent, without even the consent of their family, just by the decision of a government employee. And he said euthanasia poses a danger to the most vulnerable people in society, the elderly and the ill, who should be protected. And euthanasia removes the opportunity for personal growth and reconciliation. They should be using the last days on earth getting right with God and with their family. But Dr. Sykes says less than 1% of patients at St. Christopher's Hospice had problems with pain thanks to good palliative care. And that's got to be our highest priority, dealing with the pain. An even stronger case can be made for euthanasia for people incapable of choice, like the mentally handicapped or the incurably mentally ill people, than can be made for voluntary euthanasia. It's obvious that the very same case can be made for killing a mentally or physically handicapped infant after birth as can be made for killing them in the womb. So abortion and euthanasia actually go hand in hand, points out Dr. Nigel Sykes. And God made us, therefore our lives belong to him. He's our creator, and he should be our redeemer too. And so we should twice over belong to him. As we are made in the image of God, our lives are precious. For in the image of God has God made man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man must his blood be shed. In the 5th century, St. Augustine condemned suicide along with murder. He said patricide, the murder of parents, is more terrible than homicide, murder of your fellow man. But suicide or murder of yourself is the most wicked of all. And suicide really is self-murder. And physician-assisted suicide is shocking because a physician should be there to protect life. Their whole goal should be to save life, not to take it. So are those people advocating euthanasia, are they really concerned for the patient that they want to kill? Dr. Donald Murphy of the George Washington University Medical Center argued in the Journal of American Medical Association that lucid individuals probably cannot anticipate what aggressive measures they would want for themselves should they become demented. Therefore, the healthcare team should be allowed to make a unilateral decision, he said, to withhold CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, from severely demented patients who have poor quality of life. Now, he's arguing, what do they mean by poor quality of life? What is their definition? They can't define it. So in a later edition in a JAMA, or the Journal of American Medical Association, the same doctor argued that when family members direct that their relatives be resuscitated, their views about suffering and quality of life differ substantially from those of most reasonable people. Therefore, the physician should not be forced to adhere to this family preference. And so they're literally trying to argue that doctors should be given the liberty to overrule a patient, to overrule a patient's relatives, and just decide to end the patient's life when he thinks is fit. Dr. James Sorensen of Boston University said American opinion is rapidly moving towards a position where parents who have an abnormal child may be considered irresponsible. And I know that that's true because a family I've stayed with many times in Belgium, they've got a child who's Down syndrome. And they love this child. This child is a happy child, amazing, cheerful child, and a blessing to the people around. And the government in Belgium continually wants to take this child into their care. And the nurses have warned the parents, if you give them over to government care, they will euthanize this child, as is their policy, within just a matter of a few weeks. And so the parents have had to go to court and the media fighting to keep their child from being euthanized by the state. And the state has tried all kinds of manipulative attempts to take their child in so that they can euthanize the child away from the parents. And people in the streets even sometimes throw insults at these friends of mine for having a child, saying, do you not know about euthanasia? And they can see this child's got Down syndrome and is not fully mentally there. And so they assume that these are irresponsible parents because they haven't killed their child or allowed the state to kill them. So public opinion can be also shaped by the media to this. And so logically, with the introduction of abortion on demand, a severe demographic problem has been created. Developed nations have a disproportionately aging population, and so the very generation that legalized abortion is going to face euthanasia, because now you've got too many older people and much less younger people paying taxes to keep the older people on medical care and all that sort of thing. So they're reaching a stage where economically they're arguing for euthanasia, and you've seen in Canada it's being aggressively pushed. So in Canada, there have been people who are depressed, going to a doctor, I'm depressed, and doctors in Canada have literally proposed to even teenagers who come to them for depression, have you considered physician-assisted suicide? The doctors in Canada are being encouraged to promote physician-assisted suicide in patients who come to them reporting depression. You know, imagine you go, I'm feeling depressed. Have you considered physician-assisted suicide? We can help you with the drugs to end your life. I came to you for dealing with depression, and now the government wants to get rid of them. It's an economic decision in Canada. They've got too many people dependent on the state for medical care. They've got national health and all that sort of thing. And so literally it's been a high priority in Canada for physicians to promote suicide, physician-assisted suicide, but still suicide amongst their patients. I mean, that's how bad this thing can go. You legalized or stood by while they legalized abortion, and you may be euthanized against your will later on life. It's an almost economic certainty. So economics, not the quest for broadened individual liberties or increased autonomy, will drive assisted suicide to the plateau of accepted practice, said Derek Humphrey in his book, Final Exit. And he, by the way, is a supporter of Oregon's assisted suicide law. Oregon's one state in America that allows physician-assisted suicide. And in fact, this doctor, Derek Humphrey, in his Final Exit book, writes, is there in fact a duty to die, a responsibility within the family unit? That he's arguing for not mandatory euthanasia, but that people should realize you've got a duty to die to get out the way. You've gone from being an asset to society to being a burden to society. You need to get out the way, and we'll give you the drugs to help end your life quickly. So over the last few years, there's been a lot of moves to try and have euthanasia legalized. And this is one of the pillars of the humanistic agenda. We shouldn't be surprised that many of the people who are promoting it are people who have promoted everything from pro-abortion onwards. And in South Africa, we've got this battle. We've got people trying to promote euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. Let me just quote from the Hospice Association of Southern Africa. Hospice deals with people at the end of life and is meant to be there to help them. And the elderly and chronically sick who frequently feel a burden need to continue to feel valued by society in order to continue to value themselves. And dependent person may feel valueless and may feel it is their duty to ask for euthanasia so as not to be a burden. This legalizing of voluntary euthanasia is likely to lead by logical progression to involuntary euthanasia with consequent loss of respect for the value of life. And this was a submission given to Parliament in South Africa by the Hospice Association when they were trying to consider euthanasia back in 1997. And I was one of the people going to Parliament to protest this very bill that they were trying to push through there. Well, in the House of Lords, the British House of Lords vetoed the attempt to legalize euthanasia back in the 1990s in Britain. And they said, we do not think it's possible to set secure limits on voluntary euthanasia. Issues of life and death do not lend themselves to clear definition. And without clear definition, it would be impossible to frame adequate safeguards against non-voluntary euthanasia. If voluntary euthanasia is to be legalized, it would be next to impossible to ensure that all acts of euthanasia are really, truly voluntary, and that any liberalization of this law is not abused. To create an exception to the general prohibition of intentional killing would inevitably open the way to further erosion, whether by design or by inadvertence, or the human tendency to test the limits of any regulation. We are concerned that vulnerable people, the elderly, the lonely, the sick, or the distressed, would feel pressure, whether real or imagined, to request an early death. We believe the message which society sends to the vulnerable and the disadvantaged people should not, however bleakly, encourage them to seek death, but should assure them of our care and of our support in life. So that's what the British House of Lords final report said in vetoing down the attempts to legalize physician-assisted suicide back in the 1990s in Britain. In the Western world, aiding, abetting, or assisting suicide is a punishable crime. And the American Nurses Association also say we must increase our efforts to provide palliative care to those who are dying so that assisted suicide does not even become a consideration and is not sought after by anyone. And so in Britain, the doctor-assisted dying bill was rejected by 234 votes to 89 votes on the 10th of December 1997, the largest ever parliamentary turnout for a vote on euthanasia issues in the UK, and it was decisively defeated in 1997. But there's been an erosion in people's conscience since then, not only due to the media and to Hollywood. There's been quite a few films glamorizing a euthanasia such as You Before Me, which starts out as such a nice film and at the end it turns out to be propaganda to promote euthanasia. In this case, a handicapped person traveling to Switzerland to have the doctors kill him and making this into a lovely love story, but it's not. It's an ugly, horrible, disgusting promotion of murder, of physician-assisted suicide. And so you can see in America they had a Dr. Jack Kevorkian who was convicted of murder and sentenced to 10 to 25 years in prison for injecting a 52-year-old man with a lethal cocktail of chemicals in 1998. And the judge said, this trial was not about political or moral correctness of euthanasia. It is about lawlessness. It's about disrespect for a society that exists because of the strength of its legal system. No one is above the law. But you, Dr. Kevorkian, had the audacity to go on national television and show the world what you did, and you dared the legal system to stop you. Well, sir, consider yourself stopped. So this Dr. Kevorkian had used controlled substances to kill a number of people. This Kevorkian acknowledged helping 130 people to die since 1990. A retired pathologist, he had his license to practice medicine removed because of his publicizing his physician-assisted suicides for 130 people. And as the Attorney General at that time said, one of the fundamental principles of the Code of Ethics is that physicians must not act with the intent of causing the death of their patients. No civilized society can condone assisted suicide as practiced by Jack Kevorkian. He has served as a reckless instrument of death. And the American Medical Association responded to the conviction of this Kevorkian as the AMA's Council on Ethical and Judicial Affairs opinion is that physician-assisted suicide is unethical and it is in direct opposition to the role of a physician as a healer. The American Medical Association remains committed to assuring that patients' dignity and adequate relief of pain will be available at the end of their lives. And so it is against all civilized standards to have physician-assisted suicide. And I think the British bill must be vetoed. As far as I understand, your House of Lords should have the ability to veto this bill, and the King could also refuse to sign it as the executive head of state. And so I would hope that this will not go through, although apparently it's passed in the House of Commons, but I think it's a highly irresponsible bill. Assisted dying is not an advance in civilization, it's regression. And no one can foresee all the particulars relating to future injury or future illness. But what we need is to have respect for life, and medical treatment does not include life's absolute essentials like air, water, and food. And withholding air, water, and food from patients having trouble breathing or swallowing cannot be considered natural causes. Death by starvation or thirst is not death from natural causes. We need to have proper definitions, and we need to protect our vulnerable, elderly, dying, sick patients, and they mustn't have the loneliness of feeling that they're not even wanted and that the best thing they can do is to end their life so as not to be a burden on others. That is absolutely shocking. We need to speak up. We need to get involved. We need to write to our elected representatives. We need to write letters to the editor of newspapers. We need to get involved in social media. Get involved. Do more hospital visitation. Churches should be more involved in visiting people in hospital. Our Lord Jesus said, I was sick and I was in prison and you visited me. And that's what we should do. Everybody needs love, encouragement, prayer and support, especially during crisis periods in their life. And when I've been in hospital, whether as a visitor or as a patient, I've seen the desperate need of all patients. They want visitors. And that's why it was so cruel during the COVID cult that they prevented people visiting their own relatives in the hospital. And that's what forced my wife to choose to die at home, because she did not want to be in a hospital where her family couldn't even visit her. She preferred to die at home of the cancer and the chemo that had afflicted her. So I know from personal experience how this works. And our focus must be on encouragement, prayer, giving the love and support to a family member who is suffering, so that they don't consider themselves a burden and they don't even consider asking for physician-assisted suicide. Our primary concern should be dealing with pain and make them comfortable and make them feel loved and supported and wanted. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And I've got something here. I tend to look at the Daily Mail. I'm going to mute Peter because I'm getting what happens with Skype. It's that if someone talks for a while, then it throttles the other person. It takes ages to catch up. So it's obviously a way that they save money. So I'm just muting him for a moment. So Peter gave you some examples of, you know, what they tell you about euthanasia, or as they prefer to call it, assisted dying, because it's a far more sanitized word. It's one of the tactics that the powers that should be always used. They take a word commonly known for a practice and they give you a more sanitized one that they think you're more likely to accept. But here is a headline from the Daily Mail, and this is December the 9th, 2022. I'm going to read it to you. Exclusive: I don't want to die, but I don't want to be homeless. Canadian man 65 has a doctor's approval for euthanasia despite admitting becoming poor is a main reason he's applying to die. And so let's look at what they've said. There is an ITVX, that's ITV.com, that's one of our main television channels in the UK. There's a headline here: assisted dying would need approval from two doctors and a judge. Well, Peter gave you some examples of why the doctors might not be as reliable as one would hope. And I imagine there are many people doing 2-3 years in prison that might question the wisdom of some judges following them protesting the murder of 3 toddlers in the summer. But I want to take you in a different direction. I want to take you all the way back to, do you remember when we were told about civil partnerships for same-sex couples? Because, you know, they can't get married, and so, you know, we need to do that so that they can still, you know, have these civil partnerships. Well, then suddenly we've got gay marriage, then we've got Pride Week, then we've got the transgender thing being pushed, and now, this is from the Daily Mail, 16th of November 2024, so just over a couple of weeks ago. Headline: trans men and lesbians would get IVF priority 2 years ahead of heterosexual couples under NHS plan. So whatever they tell you at the outset, it always seems to develop in a direction that they've not told you. And this is what they do historically. They do everything by gradualism. It's like the camel getting its nose under the tent. Once it gets its nose under the tent, sooner or later you've got the whole damn camel in there. So, Peter, any comments before we go?
I think that's just so wise. When politicians are advocating a policy, you've got to ask why. It's not because they care about you or your well-being or your life, or they wouldn't have approved so many things that happened in 2020 and other times too. So we must free ourselves of this deluded idea that the government exists for your good. They don't. They tend to be more concerned about other interests. Bankers' interests are far more important than those of the voters and the citizens and taxpayers. You know that. So if they're trying to promote something, I think it's quite clear to me this is all about the government having more power, and they can get rid of you when it's convenient. So, for example, I know friends in Eastern Europe, when I was ministering behind the Iron Curtain during the communist years, the dark years they call it, there were doctors who would put pastors to death. And so, for example, we heard of pastors who were suddenly called in for a checkup. Now, all the medical profession hospitals were run by the government in Russia and in Romania, for example, in East Germany. So they could suddenly say, you've got to come for a checkup. Well, I'm not due for a checkup. No, you are. And in he goes, and next thing his family's told to come and collect the body, the man died. And he has just given some lethal injection by the doctor. And doctors are just a tool of the state. And so people were literally being put to death in because they were inconvenienced and they didn't want them. And they just said, well, you know, he died during a routine medical examination visiting the hospital, which he had not asked for, but the state had called for. So that's how bad it can be. They can, you know, just read George Orwell's 1984 if you want an idea of how things can go, and look at Soviet Union history to realize they actually had over 200, what did they call them, psychiatric hospitals in the Soviet Union, where they put people who were Christians and evangelists and pastors in a psychiatric hospital, subdued them with drugs, put them in padded cells with these in these straitjackets, because, well, they reject scientific socialism. They must be insane because they believe in God. And so if the government has more control, this is another tool in their toolbox, another weapon in their toolbox. If they've got the ability to have euthanasia, and if they've nationalized the hospitals, it's a way that they can put to death people that are not wanted. Because if you're able to euthanize the incurably ill and so on, what's to stop them extending that and just, you know, the mission creep that somehow or another you might be an awkward problem in society. And so you come into hospital and the state just says, get rid of this particular patient for whatever reason. And they're people who will do what they're told. And so it's all about control. It's not because they care about your health. It's not because they care about your well-being or they want to avoid you pain. I mean, they could do that by abolishing most of the government departments. And that would do a lot more good than this. Physician-assisted dying gives the government another means of getting rid of people they don't want.
Thank you, Peter. Before we go, can you please let the audience know where they can find your work and how they can contact you?
Yes, thank you. Visit www.frontlinemissionsa.org. SA short for South Africa. So www.frontline.missionsa.org. Frontlinemissionsa.org. Or you can email me personally, peter@frontline.org.za. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And both that email and that website and many of Peter's other websites will be available, as always, in the post for this show at achshow.com. So let's play the closing music. I want to thank Peter so much for joining us today for a show entitled The Real Story of Why Assisted Dying is a Bad Idea. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'll be back with you all on Saturday. And until then, folks, have a wonderful week and bye for now.